Tov, so getting back to our main topic, which is the Ten Commandments. The last commandment that we discussed, if I'm not mistaken, was the commandment obligating us to honor our parents. So today we're going to go on with the other commandments. Notice the commandments were presented on two sides of the tablets of the law, showing that both types of commandments have a certain sort of equality. The ones between man and God, which are the ones that we've discussed already, and the ones between man and man, which we're going to discuss today. But it also shows something else. They weren't presented in the air, so to speak, but they were presented on a set of tablets, the idea being that they're bonded together. They're not just equal, but they're one. So with that in mind, let's begin to discuss the commandment of not murdering. Now, there are some commandments that make us feel good. We say, like, at least that's something I don't do. Don't murder anyone, which is good. So there are two things we have to discuss, which is, what are the things that are considered by the sages to be offshoot of murder, and how does that relate to us? And another thing that we would have to discuss is, what exactly defines murder? So let's answer the second thing first. What makes something murder? Willingly taking somebody else's life is considered to be killing. Okay, for it to be murder as opposed to killing, there has to be no self-defense involved. The person involved isn't an agent of the religious court. And no irreversible situation brought about this killing. In other words, here are the things that would be exempt. A true accident, not an accident caused by negligence. For instance, I'm standing near an open window. Somebody else is running into the room that I'm standing. They knock me out the window. Somebody else is standing in the street below. I fall on that person and kill them. I'm truly an innocent victim here. I made no choices. So that case is not called murder. Okay, then you have negligence. You have situations where, for instance, a person is driving too fast because they want to get from here to there, not because they want to, God forbid, kill anyone, but they do. So that's considered murder, but through negligence, which is nowhere near as severe as our final case, which is a person actually willing another's death out of hatred with premeditation. Self-defense is a category in and of itself. True self-defense is a situation in which the likely outcome of a situation is that someone is going to die. So the question is, who should be the person who dies? And the halachic answer is the one who began the situation's outcome, the one who sought to kill someone else. So the classical case is a person who gets up in the middle of the night because they hear someone prowling around in their basement. They turn on their flashlight. They see it's a robber. They have every reason to assume that the robber is armed, because people know that people are not just going to say, oh, you want my possessions, please feel free. So they come armed, expecting the person to protest violently. So the man now on the top of the stairs is facing someone who presumably is armed. If there's no other way he could save himself, for instance, if he's a sharpshooter, he would have to wound the person rather than kill them, then his obligation is to kill the man rather than allow himself to be killed, since this man, the robber, has come with the intent of murdering. So in the world of intent, he's already doomed himself, even though in the world of deed he hasn't. While he, the victim, or the person who might be a victim if he does nothing, has had no ill intent. So what we see with all of these cases is that something that would look on the same on the outside to a Martian isn't the same at all in halacha. If the Martian were to see the first case, me standing by the window, and knew nothing of human mores, may think I hired someone to push me out the window in order to kill this person, may think I purposely arranged this in some way. Okay, the person, the Martian who sees negligence, doesn't know that the person intended just to get to work on time. For all they know, the person was stalking their victim and purposely accelerated in order to kill them. The Martian wouldn't know whether a person's killing was intentional or the result of tragic misunderstanding or threat. So what that tells us is that what makes something a murder isn't just the outcome, but the intention. Now, with that in mind, we could talk about what this has to do with us, since I assume that we don't do actual murder. The sages compare humiliating somebody else to murder. So the obvious question is why? There's so many differences. A person who's murdered is actually dead. Their life in this world is finished. A person who's humiliated can eat lunch later the same day. A person who's been killed leaves people to mourn their death. A person who's been humiliated may, in fact, not even tell anybody about it. So what's the basis for comparison? So the answer would be, and this is a very deep answer, it's the Maharal's answer, is what we see is that the real crime that was done is belittling the other person's divinity. The fact is that every single one of us is going to die in the end. Nobody is immortal. Even if Mashiach was going to come today, which is still possible, but if this was to happen, then nobody will make it into the age of revival of the dead without ever dying. Everyone has to die before that era arrives. Nobody is immortal. So when you say what's wrong with the murder is he ended that person's life, the fact is that person, whoever it is, their life was going to end at some point, just like everybody else's life. At most, you could say that they shortened the person's life. And even that's tricky to say. What do I mean when I say this? There's a halacha concerning the necessity of seeing that no accident happens on one's property, in which the Torah requires everybody who has a roof to put a fence around the roof, a parapet in fancy language, to prevent, and I want you to carefully hear the words that are used in the text, to prevent the faller from falling. Notice, the faller, hanofel in Hebrew, not the one who will fall, but the faller, the one who presently is in the act of falling. What's that supposed to mean? So Rashi explains to us that this man was going to fall off someone's roof or die in some other way. When was that determined? There are several possibilities. What is it that before he was even born? God assigned his soul a mission, and that mission has only a limited amount of time in which it could be fulfilled. 70 years, 80 years, 90 years, 120 years. But people have a limited amount of time in which to do the mission for which they were born. So that person's lifespan may have ended because he had this and this many years in which to achieve his mission, and now the time's out. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that year on Rosh Hashanah, Hashem determined that this person should die this year, even if otherwise they would have had a longer time in which to fulfill their mission. Hashem decided that they should die this year rather than some future year because they dug their hole so deeply that it's clear to him this isn't going to happen. And it's doing no favor at that point to give the person more and more and more time in which to dig their hole deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. It's another possibility. Third possibility, which in fact isn't that different than the first. The mission that people have to achieve in life has to be achieved in a finite amount of time. Especially in the case when somebody succeeds in achieving some of the goal for which they were created, it's completely conceivable they'll come back to this world a second time, a third time, fourth time, to finish whatever it is that they had to do. So when their goal is done, and we don't know what our life's purpose is, sometimes there's no more reason for more life. Sometimes that's enough. I'll give you an example. There are those who maintain that the deep connection between Rabbi Akiva and the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, the author of Mesilat Yesharim, Path of the Just, was so deep that they theorize that his 40 years were given to him as a rectification for the first 40 years of Rabbi Akiva's life, which Rabbi Akiva had not yet had access to learning, which he was an Am Haaretz, an ignoramus. possible. So we don't know when a person's life is meant to end, but we do know is that there's a time. And if that person has to go, to quote the Talmud, God has many bears, many lions. So if your roof is the one with no fence, it could be you'll be the one through whom this tragedy has to occur. So this person was going to die that day. Could be by falling off your roof, could be by tripping over his own shoelaces. But if you're the one who's the direct cause, there's a reason for it. And the reason is that you're not having a roof that's in good repair shows that you belittle the importance of life. So notice there are two things. He's going to die anyway. But you, on your side, should see that everything about the way you live affirms the value of life. There's still one other possibility, which is more complex, which is the following. Suppose a person is killed in the Holocaust, and there's no particular reason to think that they fulfilled their mission, although we never know because we don't know what went on in previous lives. Sometimes the following could happen. A tragedy is meant to happen to the entire Jewish people, such as the Holocaust. Hashem instructs the angel of destruction, do not differentiate between a righteous person and a wicked person. Don't make that differentiation. Let them be killed. Why would he give the angel of destruction that such a terrible instruction? So on a simple level, it's obvious that if only people who did things that we could see as wrong died, and all of the righteous people survived, our free choice would be out the window. But there's something else, and I want you to hear this something else because it's not a simple thought. When Hashem created the world, he created laws of cause and effect. These laws of cause and effect don't work independently of him. These laws of cause and effect that we call nature require that us contemplate what nature really means. The word nature is the same gematria as the word God. The divine name Elohim, which means master of forces, is the same gematria as the word hateva, the nature. The nature is an act of divine will. Nothing happens in nature without divine will. But the laws are there. The reason why the laws are as they are is because God wanted a world of enormous complexity to allow us to discover him and to discover ourselves through challenge and test so that we become what we choose, not just know what to choose. So in a world in which there's cause and effect, let's say in the Holocaust, somebody is shot at point blank range, it's conceivable that had there been no Holocaust, this person would have lived a longer time. But because he's caught up in this web of destruction, and Hashem decided not to break the laws of nature for this person, because their merit would have to be enormous for them to draw down that sort of energy, then that person will die, even though that might not have been their appointed time. However, when you ask, and where is justice? Realize that in this case, where the person is killed because they're caught up in the covenant that Hashem made with the Jewish people, that their place in the future life is not only guaranteed, but higher than it could become through almost any conceivable deed. So now we have several ideas concerning lo tirtzach, don't murder. The main one being is you see that you're not a murderer. So the issue here is not don't kill or don't let people die. The issue is don't you be a murderer. The question is, why is that so severe? So the answer is the only way that we could search for Hashem himself in this world and for goodness is by valuing the spirituality of the other person, by valuing their worth. It's the only way to do it. When you value the other person's worth, when you see that their value is infinite, that this person has all of the divine attributes in them, and you affirm this by choosing not to murder them. In a situation where murder would be easy, where murder would be something that burns within you to do, that's a huge statement. So let me give you an example of what I mean. I was talking to a student who, many years earlier, more than 10 years earlier, she was not yet religious. She was pregnant, and she had an abortion. In fact, she had two abortions. And now she doesn't know how she should relate to them. On one hand, her value system then, remember she wasn't religious, was such that not having an abortion was almost not even, wasn't even on the page. In fact, as soon as she realized she was pregnant, she made an appointment to do an abortion. Nobody even questioned it. Of course, you're 17, you can't have a child. How could a 17-year-old have a child? Are you crazy? So why am I telling you this? From where she stands today, personally, I doubt whether she has any real guilt here because she was brought up in a society in which her values were affected by everything she saw from the day she was born until much, much later than that era in her life. However, what hurts her now is this, that she's had so much more exposure to the preciousness of life that she extinguished some of it. Now, what she should do with that and how she should respond to it is a whole other issue. But she's come to realize that life is precious. A person should realize that their own life is precious. In Or HaTzadikim, the author says that a person who takes their own life casually, who treats their own life as though it's unimportant, and they die as a consequence, is even more guilty than a murderer. What would an example of that be? Take the example of somebody who does high-risk sports. Let's say the statistical possibilities in a given sport is that every one out of 150 people die or are severely injured. An example of that might be car racing. Okay, running the Indianapolis 500. I'm not sure if that's the statistical reality. I'm just bringing that as a possibility, because in the old days when I was a child and I watched it, I would see a lot of cars turn over. So what happens? So on one hand, it's within our nature. We want to feel everything and know everything and experience everything, but we don't realize that life isn't just about taking in. Life is about giving out. There are people we have to help, things that we have to rectify, ways that we have to make straight. Our lives are too precious to waste. So Lo Tirtzach, if you understand it, would also have something to do with sentencing yourself to the slow death of wasting time, of wasting your years. Something to think about. So what does this have to do with humiliating someone? If you humiliate someone, then at least momentarily, that person ceases to see their own divinity and their own significance. What do they see? We all know this. The more true an insult is, the more painful it is. If you're very quiet and reticent, and somebody says you have a big mouth, you just look at them. What are you talking about? But if you know you talk too much, this is very painful to hear. Okay, and the same would hold true with any insult. This is why, and I find this very interesting, in ancient times the court was empowered to have people pay damages for humiliating people. It's called boshet. How much should they pay? How much is an insult worth? So the answer is it would depend, among other things, on who gave the insult. If a credible person humiliated someone, an important person, they would have to pay much more than if a common person, a vulgar person, insulted them, because their insult would be more credible and therefore more painful. So when you insult somebody, what you're saying is you're not significant. And in that sense also, when you do anything that teaches a person their own significance, either actually saving a life It goes more beyond saving that person. In a certain sense, it's as though they save the whole world, because the world is made more whole through that person's divine image. It's that big. There are other ways in which we could give somebody a sense of their significance. Being with them in their time of brokenness, for instance, this is a person who visits the sick, lifts a 60th of their illness, which is akin to saving them in a certain sense. Affirming someone, validating them, appreciating them. All of that gives them a sense of their significance and their worthiness of life. Let's go on to the next one. The next one is lo tin'af, don't commit adultery. So let's first define adultery. Adultery means any affair that a man has with a married woman, whether he's married or he's single. Adultery is a death sin. So in this sense, it's a bit prejudiced against men, since either a single man or a married man could end up killed, while only a married woman is considered an adulteress. What's this about? Why is it so awful, so bad, for man to have an affair with a married woman? Not that it's good for a man to have an affair with any woman who isn't his wife, single or married. Not that that's condoned in any way. But it's not a death sin. That means, in theory, you could have a man who lives a good life, gives charity, believes in a cause. And the Torah is basically saying all of that has no value if he's with another man's wife. Let's think about what that implies. There were people who, by the standards of our time, were considered great people, but who were adulterers. Certain American presidents, Martin Luther King Jr., Kennedy, okay. What's so terrible about this? So the idea is that only a man and wife together are considered to be a whole human being. It says in the Torah itself, male and female, I created them and called their name Adam. When they're together, they're called a full human being. The way men work is that they draw down what Hashem gives them. They give it to their woman, therefore they want to provide. What she has to do is to take what he provides and turn it into something. Okay, so it's within the woman's nature to want one man in her life. The man who she's going to accept from and turn what he gives into something of value. Which is why this difference between male and female nature is why in virtually every society there are men who go astray. There are brothels, there are prostitutes. And the women who they're with don't have to pretend to care for them. But a woman doesn't want that sort of relationship. She wants a relationship in which she's valued, in which what she does to turn what the man gives her into something, into a life, into a family, is valued and recognized. So because of this, what I find very interesting is that even in promiscuous societies, women in general don't want and don't even tolerate simultaneous relationships, what they call to one-night stands. It cheapens them and belittles them. And they're right in this feeling. So this is where the mitzvah lo tin'af comes in. It means don't destroy the humanity of the couple. Don't do this. So there's a Gemara that talks about how awful things were at the time of the destruction. One of the stories are as follows. The daughter of one of the sages was being sold on the slave block, clearly to be used. Now, in those days, women used to wear seven different garments. So the prospective buyer looked at her and said, well, I can't see who she is. Let's see who she is. So the trader took off one garment. He said, I want to see more. I can't really see her. Two garments, three garments, four garments. By the time he was about to take off the last garment, the girl literally died. She couldn't bear being exposed in this way. Look at what we've come to. Today, we take off all seven garments ourselves. We've lost any sensitivity to what it is to preserve ourselves, to see that only our inner selves are the self that we present to the world, and that our bodies are something that we give to someone who we care for in marriage, in holiness, in purity. Why am I bringing this up? Because not committing adultery has to do with being a person who destroys the bond that makes a man and woman human. When a man hunts, or a woman knowingly becomes prey, she makes herself prey, both parties are becoming less human. The man who hunts women is becoming externalized, bestial, exploitive. The woman who defines herself as prey is doing the same. So the question is, why is it so attractive? Why is this role of being prey so attractive? So the simple reason is that every woman wants to marry, and deep within our subconscious, we know that the only way a man is going to marry a woman is if he finds her attractive, at least to some degree. She can't force herself upon him. Okay, but there's something deeper as well. The society in which we live is very superficial and materialistic. And because of that, any sensitivity to personhood, as opposed to physical appearance and the pleasure that it could give, becomes progressively dimmer. So every so often we have to ask ourselves, who do we want to be? What identity do we want to bring forth? The body or the soul? And this should affect what we choose to wear. People will say, well, let someone look beyond what I wear. Why do I have to care about what I wear? So the fact is, what you wear is your statement to the world about how you want people to see you, how you want them to perceive you. If I was wearing a policewoman's uniform, you would have every reason to think I'm a policewoman. I put it on. So you have to ask about the message that you choose. Nobody chooses it for you. Now, these two first commandments on the second side of the Luchot, don't murder, don't commit adultery, parallel the first two commandments on the other side of the Luchot. I am the Lord your God, and don't have any gods before me. Affirming somebody's spirituality, not negating it through murder, parallels, know that I'm God. This is how you acknowledge God. You acknowledge the spirit and the soul of the other person. Don't commit adultery. Don't destroy the bond that makes you human. Parallels, don't have other gods before me. Don't let your self-worship and your desires cause you to lose track of what godliness is really about. Now we're on to the third one. Okay, the third one is lo tignov. Don't steal. The stealing that's under discussion in the Ten Commandments isn't monetary theft, but rather it's kidnapping. Okay, why is kidnapping called theft? What's being stolen? So let's first talk about what kidnapping is in halacha. The halachic definition of kidnapping is taking somebody against their will where they don't want to be, and holding them for ransom, meaning you're selling them for money. So just taking someone to where they don't want to be, for instance, a policeman arresting someone and putting him in the paddy wagon, isn't kidnapping, because the policeman isn't holding the man for profit. Okay, so an example of something that may be wrong, but isn't kidnapping, is what often happens in divorces, where one parent is declared to be the custodial parent, and the other parent doesn't return the child after visitations, or disappears with the child, even worse. In which case, according to secular law, that's called kidnapping. In halacha, it's certainly the wrong thing to do, but it's not at all comparable to holding somebody for monetary gain. What's so bad about kidnapping and selling someone? So what's so bad about it is that it reduces someone to being merchandise. So you could look at a person, instead of saying Anne, or Bradley, or Diane, or Fagel, whatever name you use, you're looking at them and seeing money. You're looking at them and seeing favors. You're looking at them and not seeing who they are as a human being at all. Every so often, I read the Arab News Service, Al Jazeera, and I want you to know this is exactly how they speak about the Israeli soldiers that they have captive. The vocabulary they use is the vocabulary of a merchant in the bazaar. They've long stopped thinking of them as people. I don't know if they're alive or not, in fact. But assuming that they're alive, in the eyes of their captors, they have no human value at all. And in fact, the Arabs recently declared publicly, it was in a speech that one of the leaders of the Hamas made, that it's good business to capture Israeli soldiers. That's how they see it. So you could say, well, at least, again, this is something I don't do. I don't kidnap people. And I'm glad that we don't. Nobody here does. But looking at people exploitively in any way is something that we have to sometimes question ourselves about. If one's attitude towards another person is ever, how could I use him? In the negative sense, not how I could employ him. How could I use him? Then there's something to think about. This commandment is parallel to the commandment to not use God's name in vain. What does one thing have to do with the other? So the idea is that God's name means how we define him and describe him, which again, there's no way through which we find God more readily than through another human being and seeing his hashivas and divinity, as we said before. The fourth one of the last five is don't give false testimony. So the concept of giving false testimony, what does that mean? It means not going to court and saying what you want under oath for purposes of your own. But I want to tell you something. I don't know if any of you who listen are lawyers, but if any of you are, you'll know that what I'm telling is true. If you're honest in court, you always lose. What do I mean by this? Let's say this happened to my sister-in-law last week. There was unseasonable floods in some parts of Israel. So the water came into her apartment. She has an apartment on two levels, an entrance level and a downstairs. And the whole downstairs was flooded. So this is where her appliances are, her washer, dryer, her beds, the wood that her bed's made of is warped, her closets, her papers, a lot of her clothing, linens. It's a lot of damage. Now, the insurance on her apartment has a $2,500 deductible. So that means if she wants to get anything at all, she has to present the damage as though it's certainly more than $2,500 to get even $1. So she didn't make the terms of this insurance policy because, in fact, the reason why the flood damage took place was that the sewers were closed for the summer. So the court case is against the water supply company, which is called Gihon. So the photographer who came, because he identifies more with my sister-in-law than he does with her, with his employer, Gihon, because people never identify with public companies, did everything to maximize the way the damage looks. Why? Because for her to get anything, it has to be more than actually occurred. So let's say the real damage is worth $10,000. For her to be paid her $10,000, besides all of the anguish and the wasted time and all of the just seeing your stuff ruined, which they don't pay anything for her to get $10,000 worth of damage just to cover what she lost, she would have to sue for $12,500. So if you're a good lawyer, what will you do? You'll sue them for $20,000, settle for $12,500 or something around there, and she'll barely get her losses back. And if you do this, you feel okay. You don't feel like a thief. You didn't get her back even 1 cent more than her actual loss was. But it requires lying, swearing falsely, doing all the things the Torah tells us not to do. Are you allowed to do it? The answer is no. Because your word is worth more than money. And the invocation of an oath is a very serious thing. And I want to point out that in divorce cases, I don't know if any of you are divorced, thinking of divorce, will be thinking of divorce, this is such common practice. In order to get things on one's own terms, virtually all of the men lie and say their wives, or their soon-to-be former wives, are emotionally unbalanced, and therefore they should have at least financial custody or whatever. The wives all say that the husbands are abusive, physically or otherwise, and therefore should compensate them and certainly shouldn't have financial custody and should give large amounts of alimony. And the judges have become so hardened that they never believe anybody, which isn't good for anything. So every so often a person has to take a deep breath and question what's going to endure and what's really valuable in this world. Obviously, every case is its own story, and there is something about the nature of especially secular courts that necessitate you're asking a paskening rav, a rav who's expert enough in halacha, as to how much you have to really, really sacrifice. But the answer is sometimes it's going to be real. Sometimes the sacrifice is going to be real. And it's not so simple at all. What is this parallel to? It's parallel to keeping Shabbos. What's Shabbos about? As we said when we spoke about Shabbos, we said that what Shabbos is about is stepping out of the picture so that you could see the picture. Anyone who keeps Shabbos obviously isn't working 7 days, is obviously losing money. Anyone who spends money beautifying Shabbos is spending money. It's okay, though, because you can't see the picture or appreciate life if you never step out and see the Creator and the beauty of His world. Similarly, truth is so important. The soul knows the truth. If you can't at least trust your own words and believe what you say, you're lost. Last of these commandments. The last of these commandments is not to covet anything that belongs to someone other than yourself. Not his wife, not his home, not his servants, not his field, nothing. Let's define coveting. There are two sorts of coveting. One is worse, and the other is even worse. Okay. So what is the worst sort of coveting, and what's even worse? The worst is saying, you want it because I have it, and it's true. Are there people who want things only because somebody else has them, not because they need them? Of course. People buy all sorts of things because somebody else has it. An example of that would be, I'm sure some of you buy the New York Times. If you look at the Sunday supplement, the real estate ads, you see these beautiful mansions. Some of them have 20 rooms, 23 rooms, 25 rooms even. How big are the families that live in these mansions? Did you ever think about this? I'll tell you when I thought about this. A friend of mine showed me some ads, and we were looking at them in my living room. My children were young then. And I was just like, wow, they must have so many kids. So I said, what do you mean? So she was counting the windows, and she was figuring, like, every window must be in a room. So they must have, like, 30 kids. And, like, maybe some of them, you know, like, she's had it all figured out. There were, like, at least two in a room, maybe some bunk beds. She was getting up to, like, 60, 70 kids. Now, you and I know the truth. Who probably lives in a mansion? Middle-aged husband and wife, maybe two kids who are married. Okay, maybe not. But by and large, these huge homes are not necessarily owned by people who have lots of kids or who have lots of guests. They don't need it, but they have it because it gives them a sense of self-affirmation. When you need self-affirmation from the outside, then you're doomed to jealousy because there are always going to be things that other people have that you don't, because everybody is only given exactly what they need to do their life's mission. So this, I have to have it because everybody has it, it's a terrible thing for us. I have a friend who came close to divorce because for various reasons she and her husband are not able to purchase their own home. They have a lovely rented home. But to her it's so clear that it's a badge of failure because the others have their own home, that she was on the verge of one of the most self-destructive things one could imagine because it was a good marriage other than this. There's still worse kind of coveting, though. The worst sort of coveting is, you have it, I want it, and listen to this, and therefore I don't want you to have it. Even if I don't have it, I don't want you to have it either. Do people get that way? Absolutely. If I can't have it, then you're not going to have it either. I want you to picture doing a terrible thing to a small group of children. Suppose you have four children of five in front of you, and you give each one a lolly. Four lollies. Four kids, four lollies. One, two, three, four. Are they going to be happy? Yes. Then give one of them a second lolly. What's going to happen then? Hysteria. And probably attacking the child who did nothing wrong. I read one of the most appalling things. I mean, in Africa, so much is appalling. But I read something that was particularly appalling. A journalist was there, and she was in a camp where most of the children were orphans. And she saw a little boy who was literally just wearing a sack. It was from one of the charities that give out food. So she was wearing a light shirt, and over that she was wearing a flannel shirt, a sort of a sweater. So she took off the flannel shirt and she put it on him. It was too big, but it covered him completely, and it was colorful, and he liked it. And when she was flying out of there, she began to cry. Somebody asked her, "What's wrong?" And she said, "I did such a stupid thing. I did such a stupid thing." I said, "What did you do?" She said, "I gave this kid my shirt. The bigger kids are going to take it from him. They're going to beat him. He's not even going to have his sack. I was so stupid." And you know what? She was right. So what could you do with it if you really feel envy towards people? A friend of mine who's a lovely person, is a woman in midlife. She married, but she divorced. She doesn't have children. She told me it's hard for her to go out when the kids come out of school, seeing all the mommies and their little kids running to them. So she doesn't go out then. Now she's very self-aware, and she realized the one who owns this problem is her. She realized it's not their problem, which a lot of people don't. But what do you do with it? So Ibn Ezra gives us a mashal that we have to learn to apply to our own lives. It says, once there was a villager, and this villager lived far, far out in the boondocks. And where he lived, you could be there your whole life and not see anybody out of the village. It was so remote. He was ambitious. So at some point he decided, whatever's going to happen, I'm going to get myself to the city. So somebody came to the village with merchandise. He begged the man to take him with him. He got to the city. Now the day he got to the city was the day that once a year the princess would have a whole procession where she would go out of her palace, greet the people in a palanquin chair, and a chair that was borne by carriers. And she, of course, was secluded in this chair. She's sitting there. There are curtains. She just draws aside the curtains to greet the people. Then it's closed immediately. And he pushed himself to the front row so that he could see her. He got a glimpse of her. She didn't look like the girls of the village. Beautiful, made up, gems. Nonetheless, is this peasant going to go over and propose marriage to her? Of course not. Because it's so clear to him that she's from a different world. The same way it's clear to us, for instance, if I'm in Harnoff where I live and I'm standing at the bus stop and I hear a helicopter, I look up, I could see that the helicopter says number one. That means it's Olmert's helicopter, okay, the Prime Minister's helicopter. Am I going to say, why am I boiling in the sun waiting for the 15 bus when he has a helicopter? It's clear to me that's a different world. I'm not the Prime Minister. So what we have to realize is that each and every one of us really is a unique and different world. Each one of us has exactly what we need to do what we have to achieve in life. Somebody else's life wouldn't fit us. It would be like a shoe that's too tight or too big. We have exactly what we need for our own lives. So that doesn't mean you shouldn't be ambitious. You see somebody who has something that you need, not something that you want only because they have it. It's reasonable to say, how could I earn up money and buy it? But it's not reasonable to not ask the question, why do I need it, before you buy it? And what's even worse is it's certainly not worth saying, I don't want them to have it. Do people do this? This is a trap that people fall into all the time. I'll give you an example. Picture yourself at Neve Yerushalayim in the dorms. Okay, you come from a difficult family background. You're not the most academic person in the world. You also aren't that nice, let's be honest. And you have a roommate who's perfect, Ms. Perfect. Beautiful, loving family, wealth, bright, personable, good-looking. Okay. You go out on a blind date, a shidduch date, and at the end of the date, what's the worst thing you could hear from the guy if you liked him? It's so nice meeting you. I really wish you all the best. Translate that. I don't want to see you again. I'm not going to call. I'm not going to tell the shadchan, no, no, no. In fact, if you were to go to the moon, couldn't care less. That's what that means. So you go home and you cry, and then it's over. Get on with your life. In the meantime, the shadchan decides to introduce this young man to your roommate. Before you know it, she's getting engaged. And here it is. She's going with him to pick up her family at the airport. The Bradley bunch is now, the Brady bunch is now here to come. And she's putting on jewelry that he gave her. You could kill her. If her pearl necklace breaks, you'll find yourself kicking the pearls under the closet. But at that moment, you forgot something. What did you forget? That even if she didn't exist, he already wasn't going to marry you. He wasn't introduced to you then, to her rather. He doesn't want to marry you because he doesn't want to marry you. There's somebody else there for you, not him. So you have to take other people out of the equation completely. 100%. Okay, so this one of the Ten Commandments is parallel to honoring your parents, which, as you recall, I told you was the most difficult of all mitzvot. What the two have in common is that they both require you to get out of your own frame and to move into the frame of hashgacha, of seeing Hashem's providence, of seeing that the parents who you have are the parents you're meant to have. The objects that you have are the objects you're meant to have. The body you have is the body you're meant to have. The capacities that you have are the capacities that you're meant to have. The acceptance you have, everything. Everybody has exactly what they need to be themselves. So this is how the Ten Commandments end. And indeed, these Ten Commandments are so huge in their scope that the sages tell us that the whole Torah comes forth from them. So it's as though this is like a well from which all this water comes. So it's something worth knowing and accepting. Shavuot is upon us, okay? just another few days. So the main thing that we have to bear in mind is that when Shavuos comes in our hearts, we should say Nasa v'nishma sincerely. We'll do it, we'll hear it, we'll make it us, not just make it our own or learn it, but make it us, because this is the most important endeavor we could ever make. You should have a wonderful Shavuos.